My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest is a former Royal Engineer and SAS reservist. Following a traumatic childhood, he found solace in joining the military and thrived during his 15-year career. We speak about suicide, mental fitness, business, and how this podcast saved his life. Episode 40, Des Fraser. This is Declassified. Where was you born?
So born on the Wirral, Birkenhead, just a little town outside Liverpool. Nice little area for me to grow up, but it was really rough during the '80s. So there was a lot of violence, a lot of drugs. Birkenhead was actually been documented in a couple of series from the BBC as being smack city of the UK because of obviously the docks in the area where it was all brought into. But yeah, so the place itself, run down, ex-dockers type of location, but yeah.
Was that why it was originally built then, for the docks?
Yeah. It was massive for the docks. Obviously, after Thatcher and stuff like that, she started closing them down. That was the start of it all.
So it was all council?
Council estates, yeah.
Yeah.
I lived on a little one right by Birkenhead Park. There was a few larger ones around. Certainly like the north end of Birkenhead was notorious for being quite a rough area. But as I say, with the Wirral, as you push out a little bit further towards West Kirby, Coldy and places like that, really affluent areas, but Birkenhead tends to be quite still now, even a rough area.
Close-knit?
Very close-knit communities, yeah. Like, you can walk into next-door neighbours and she'll give you a sandwich or they'll give you a sandwich or anything like that. I think now if you knocked on my mum's door and you didn't know her, she'd still invite you in and give you food. So that's what sort of community it's like.
Really?
Yeah.
That's what Liverpool was renowned, especially Liverpool, Wirral was renowned for, like, the Irish contingent and people coming from all around the country to kind of thrive and get the work. Was that, so did that carry on then? Was it that kind of...
Yeah. And I still think, not as strong, but it's still there today to a degree. But yeah, years ago, certainly in the 80s, it wouldn't be unusual for you to eat in different people's houses up and down your street. And it was just like, no one had anything, but what they did have, they shared. And it was a real, really, really close-knit community.
Yeah. Do you have any really strong, kind of vivid memories of early childhood? I'm on about 3-4 years old.
I sort of lost quite a lot of my memories, but I'd say my most vivid would go back to me dad's funeral, actually. Me and my mum sat about 3 rows in, and then looking back at me sister, she was at my half-sister, she was sitting in row 7 or something like that. I just remember looking at her, not understanding what was going on, but thinking, why aren't me and her together type thing? And I would say that's my earliest memory that I can look back on. It's as if I blocked out quite a lot around that time.
You mentioned your dad. Did you ever any memories of your dad growing up?
It's hard to see because obviously photographs give you false information when it comes to storing memories. None that I can remember, if I'm honest. But then obviously there's photographs of me in the park and then walking around and doing stuff where I sort of think that I can remember it, but it's not. It's from the actual photo itself.
Yeah. The circumstances of your dad dying, I mean, you didn't know as a kid, but you were told later on in life. But did you appreciate that the fact he died growing up as a young one?
Yeah, it was, to be honest, I was a bit envious of other children who had the complete family because you needed that in those times, certainly on a council estate when everyone was quite poor. So I would look, my mum used to have to do all the jobs in the family unit. So she would be the mum, the dad, the discipliner, the lover, the one who puts you on the guidance path. But also the financial side of it as well, because my dad had a really good job prior to his death. He was a steel erector on really massive amounts of money at the time. And then my mum would work 3 jobs to not even scrape by.
After he died?
After he died, yeah.
Did you see much of her growing up?
Of my mum?
Yeah.
Well, my nan lived next door but one. And between them, they'd done an amazing job of protecting us and guiding us through life, yeah. So yeah. My mum would work quite a lot. It was quite lonely, actually. Even though I lived next door but one, I could go to my nan's at any point, but I'd spend quite a lot of time in on all alone, to be fair.
Yeah, because she'd graft in.
She was working hard, yeah. She had a care job in the day, then she was working behind the bar, she was doing cleaning jobs, even like anything that she could get to, she would do. She remember working in a chicken factory and stuff like that, just to bring money into the house.
Mm. Do you feel safe growing up?
To a degree. Like, so when I was in a nice family environment with my nan and my mum, then yeah. But we had quite a lot of distractions growing up. I had a couple of aunts who were drug addicts. My uncle, who was quite strict. When I look back now on memories, so if you stepped out of line, you'd know about it.
Mm.
With a good hiding, as it used to be said. But also, like, my auntie was a drug addict. She used to come round to the house, smash windows, hit me nan, and it went to a degree where she'd like slice her own wrists in front of us, just to get money for drugs. She'd be all nice 1 second, and then all of a second she would completely tear on you.
Mm. Don't mention names, but talk about that situation as a little child. So you're in your nan's house, which you felt safe in.
Yeah.
And then your auntie would come in. So your nan's daughter.
Yeah. So I'll go into like one of the instances, but there was many. So this would happen maybe once a month, once every 2 months sometimes. But whenever she needed money for drugs, we'd be in the kitchen, for instance. The window would be a little bit open, and then all of a sudden their head would pop under.
Mm.
And then it'll be threats to self-harm, threats to get us. And you just look at it and you think, wow, what do I do here? There's nowhere I can hide now. This is my only bit of safe zone, and you're completely taking that away from us. And I live with it with their son as well. So, as I say, one day she come in. My nan had, you know, made her some food and tried to talk to her and stuff. And she was like, well, I want money now. And I was like, I haven't got any. I mean, she genuinely never. We were quite poor, like, when I look back. And then me and her son were there. She then walks over to the drawer, pulls out a big, like knife, like the one that my nan would use for meat, and then just opened up her wrists. But this happened several times.
Mm-hmm.
But I just remember, that was taking me back when I was 7 years of age. That was one of my other memories where I just looked and, like, you would see everything in the wrists down to the bone. And then there was just blood everywhere. Blood used to knock me nan sick as well. She could never take it from her childhood. Like, her childhood comes back from being, her dad was in the Spanish Civil War, come back, didn't know the children, to be fair, because he'd gone just as they went, got evacuated. And, like, her dad had stabbed her mum in the leg with a big, massive knife at the time. So any sort of sign of blood used to tear me nan inside. That was even if one of us fell off a bike or something. So to see a wrist to the bone, and you could see tendons and stuff like that, it was horrendous. And I would say these are the memories that used to, like, really stick with you know, vivid.
The kind of pandemonium of it, like the chaos of that kind of situation, or that scenario, especially with your nan, was it noisy? Was it frantic? Was it?
It would be, but you wouldn't. I don't remember seeing it as frantic. I just remember probably being in a little bit of shock. Like, so I'd freeze, and I know I'd look at Ollie, and it'd have a really negative effect on him because of it. It was his parents, his mum, and he would be completely upset. I had a little bit. I built up a bit of a hatred towards it, so I was more anger. Like, why is this happening to us? And why, like, seeing him upset, and it would really grip me and make me want to, it would make me feel really angry. I want to try and do something about it. But as a 7-year-old child, there's no way you're doing anything.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't just one of your aunties. There was there was a few that it was...
Yeah, well, there was another one. Yeah, she was the older one who was on drugs as well. Like, I remember her bringing in a gun into my nan's house. My nan is, like, is just completely... Or she was completely against violence. There's not a bad bone in her body.
Mm.
She couldn't hurt a fly type. Really, really just an amazing woman. And then, yeah, she brought a gun in when she was off her head on drugs. Someone got shot in the leg in my nan's living room with the gun. So, yeah, when I talk about memories, I remember that happened. I remember coming in and seeing the gun. It's only after that then when I've spoke about the situation, someone said, oh, yeah, and she shot her brother's friend in the leg. And you're thinking, wow.
Well, why would she have had a gun?
She was into a lot of stuff. So there'd be crime. Bear in mind, down the docks, so you're talking prostitution, robberies, thefts.
Mm.
It was, as I say, a really nasty time to live in that particular place.
And heroin itself, what kind of effect would that have had on, especially your family, really?
Oh, it was for me as an individual, it was embarrassment. Like, because kids would say, you know, oh, your auntie's done this to us, and you'd be like, oh, but it's not like my immediate family had anything to do with it. I mean, like, my mum was one of nine, so there was two bad apples in it. But sort of the older one was never really. She kept herself to herself, and we very rarely seen her. As I say, that incident with the gun, you would see her maybe once every couple of years.
Mm.
Whereas the younger one, you would see every single month, or you'd hear stories about it. It was happening on your doorstep. So you were susceptible to bullying a little bit. And you sort of accepted the bullying because she was doing so much bad. And you couldn't take it away from her. So what my mum done is changed my surname from theirs to my dad's. And just to try and shelter me a little bit for when I went into, you know, certainly high school and stuff like that. Well, another example of how the estate worked is we must have been around five or six, myself and Lee, and we found someone who'd been stabbed in the belly. And you come over to these situations, and I'm saying, do you want me to pull her out?
Who was?
So there's just two drug addicts have been fighting. One had stabbed the other. He's lying there in like a sort of a W position, if you like, protecting the abdomen with a knife sticking out. And then me and Lee come across it, and then we were talking about like which one of us should pull the knife out. So these sort of memories, really traumatic. And that when you say vivid memories of childhood, a lot of mine tend to be of that nature.
Yeah.
There was loads of nice ones as well, but they were the ones that I always refer back to.
You mentioned earlier on, like, with discipline and your mum having to discipline, but when she wasn't around, did... I know your uncle had a part to play in disciplining in the especially the boys that were around at childhood. You mentioned good hiding, right? I don't know what do you mean, like a slap? What would that?
No, so I just remember one incident mainly, and I can't remember what we'd actually done for it, but literally grabbed quite physically to the point where. When you got hit, you would have bruises. And something that, you know, now I look at having my own child, it's like a million miles away from any sort of discipline that we would ever do. However, it happened, but what it done is it sort of made you physically tough. So that wasn't there, but they were when I say a hiding, you got a really, like, smacked by a big man who was very aggressive. Several times, to the point where you just sob. And then when we go upstairs, you'd be crying. My nan used to have to obviously watch this, but then afterwards she'd say, come downstairs, get you some supper, you know, make you feel a little bit better about it. Which, so I suppose that safe zone was impeded again when it comes to things like
that. Why would he do that? Why would a big... How big was he? Because you're 6'3".
Oh, he's about 6'3". Yeah. He's about 6 foot.
So he's about 6 foot and how big, like...
19 stone, 18 stone, something like that.
And he'd fight men?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you had to fight. You had to fight everyone in that time. And so he wore the book because me only never had dads around. And it was just me mum and me nan who would discipline us and one of our other aunts. He would then come over and try and be the alpha male. And he only knew one way back then. He's such a lovely man now, like you would never even think about it. But there was a lot of, certainly with Lee, a lot of like mind games to break him down, calling them names. And not, he was struggling, Lee, anyway, with the fact that his mum used to do that in front of us. He didn't have a great relationship with his dad at the time. I was obviously, my mum's working all the time. I'm with me nan most nights because I didn't have a dad around. So he would come in and try and be this alpha male. But like, as I say, my memories of it, they were quite painful.
Mm.
But then the other side, he would take us fishing and like you'd learn some, you know, good skills in that sense and have a little bit of an adventure. But it was, and the way to describe it is wicked. It was wicked. Some of the torture and some of the words that we use, some of the, as I say, the physical side of it, it could be wicked.
Mm. I mean, it, judging by that, so he'd not close fist punch you, but beat you up.
No, big hands, and you would feel it, yeah.
As a 6, 7-year-old, 8-year-old.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Drunk? Is he drunk?
No, never. No, no. He was just a very aggressive man, to be fair. There's other instances where I can remember with his own children as well. It was just the way he was. And I think he'd had a lot of problems from his... Because my granddad used to hit me nan. Mm. She had 9 children. And her husband used to always beat her. So he'd seen that right the way through. So, perpetual violence. We see her all the time. People coming from a house where there's been domestic violence, thinking that's the absolute normal way to live life then future. As I say, towards the latter years, you wouldn't even relate that same man to him.
Mm. Tell me about when you stole the chicken.
Oh yeah.
It's so, quite funny, but
So my aunt couldn't cook. She was quite useless, so it was around Christmas time. And myself and Lee, we'd gone in into the kitchen cupboard where the chicken had been cooked, and like a tea towel over the top of it, my nan used to pour to keep the flies off. And obviously, me and Lee took the chicken into like a little shoe cupboard and absolutely smashed it. We destroyed this chicken, and then give me aunt a little piece, who was 5 years older than us. And I'm sort of trying to blame her, but it weren't, it was me and him. But I remember after that, we got, as I say, a good little beating, to be fair, probably too far. And I remember lying on the landing and shouting to my nan after it once he'd gone, can the chicken robbers come down? But yeah, so my nan bring us down, get us some cereal and some like little goodies, and then that would, you know, you're back in your safe zone.
Did he ever show remorse? Or was that was his way of
it's quite
looking
hard
after
because
you?
He loved you as well. He to this day now, like he loves me, like me and him have a relationship where he was in hospital not long ago and I was helping him out, but he was just he was very physical back then, and I don't know whether it was a time of the times or, but under no circumstances was it ever warranted, and I think with this message that I'd like to get out there as well, is that if someone is doing this to the children, there's a longer pain to be had from it, and it takes a long time to recover because you realise that they take more than just giving you the pain there, and then it's taking your safe zone away. And if someone obviously is on the receiving end of any violence like that, then just you need to speak out and get away from it.
Did you miss your dad at this point?
Yeah, massively. So when I was young, everything I'd done was all by myself. So whether it would be joining a football team, I'd have to go and source the football team. I'd have to then travel to and from the football team, sometimes jumping on a train without a ticket or whatever else. And then boxing the same. I went to two different boxing gyms. But it was always like finding the money. I had to fund it as well as get there, as well as obviously do the actual activities as well. So no one ever directed me. There was no real role model in that sense to push you forward.
You have drive though. Was you a driven kid?
Massively, yeah. So like my like going back into our house was spotlessly clean, but my room was like extra spotlessly clean. So it was almost as if my brain had to control the things that I had control of.
Mm.
And then just blank out the rest. So if I couldn't control it, then it wasn't a big issue. However, the stuff that I could was on fire.
Yeah.
And it had to perform at a really good standard.
So what sports was you into?
So boxing and football were my main two. Anything else that I could put my hand to. So if I'd done a little bit of fishing, it'd be nice to get away. I would try that. But coming again from our estate, you know, the boxing gym at the about a mile away, and then my local football club was like Birkenhead Boys.
As a, I suppose, going into teenage years, really. But would you, or even before that as well, you know, from a young, you know, maybe 8, 9, 10, was you fighting kids on the estate as well?
Oh yeah.
Was it aggressive? Was it in a violent child? I know you said earlier on, but growing up into like the '90s now, was it violent?
No, I was quite an aggressive young lad as well. I don't know whether it was the beatings that were the catalyst for it, but for instance, one time I'd come in and I had like big brown eyes and I was quite upset. Sat at the table and these kids who were a couple of years older than me had just battered me down an entry. And when I say battered, I mean like physically, you know, got stuck into me, punching, kicking and stuff. And then they come past and said to me, "Mum, oh, we've just hit your Des." Like, I mean, Mum was turned around to me, "They just hit you?" And I was like, yeah, thinking I was going to get sympathy. What a shock. She said to me, "If we don't get out there now and fucking kill them, I'm going to do you." So I just looked at her eyes and she was like raging. So straight away I was thrown out of the house and then got stuck into both of them.
Mm.
Come back in, my mum pulled me off one and was like, "See, did that hit you?" I was like, "No." She goes, "No, that's what you do every time." So that was sort of the mentality that you've got to fight. And then going into like from primary school into high school, that was when it became quite problematic, that system that my mum had put in place. It defended myself quite well on the estate and outside the school. But we had like a written rule of I could never ever try and hit someone for nothing. So
start a fight.
Instigator, yeah. But if someone tried it with me, then I had full green light to fight them back. But also if they're seeing other people being bullied as well. And I had this like bit of a moral compass to try and help them, if you like. So got into high school, I was getting suspended quite a lot for fighting, like up to about 17 times in my first couple of years.
It's quite a few times.
it was on my last warning. Yeah,
all for fighting.
I would say 80% of them. Yeah. Definitely. Another one. I took a bag with two guns into school. It was like Wembley Tempest, those were like real powerful
pellet guns,
ball bearing guns. And I shot the blackboard, shattered the blackboard. And then when my mum came to school, the teacher was like, "Here's Desmond's guns." And my mum was like, "I can assure you they're not Desmond's." And I was like, "Please, mum, just put them aside." He's like, "Yeah, I took them off of myself."
Yeah. Were you clever?
I think I was, yeah. I didn't apply myself. In certainly in the first 2 years, I was more... It's quite hard... I think I had loads of distractions. So as I say, with my aunt, that used to cause me a lot of trouble when I got to school.
Because
people could say things like, you know, "She's a prostitute, she's this, she's done that." And it used to always have me on complete edge. And I used to feel quite ashamed. I think the poverty side of it as well, not having the things that other kids had, used to knock your self-confidence. So in turn, wouldn't then put you on in a defensive way. But then I remember after my last time I got suspended for fighting, the school had just said, "Listen, we really love Desmond being in school. However, this is it now. He doesn't have any more chances. he's going into his third year of school, which, you know, the GCSEs options start. Then you take the GCSEs the last 2 years. And this is his last chance. He's going to end up in a naughty school. So the only person who I could actually say was a role model when I was a child was my uncle, Dave, who was married to my auntie, Jane. And he pulled me aside. My mum used to use this brilliant technique of being disappointed with me. And it was the only thing that beat me. So, like, when I say physical hiding's never done anything, just, like, completely I could take it. But mum would say, I haven't raised you and put so much into you for you to act like this now. Like, I need you to stop. I need you to make something of you. So we sort of inspired a couple of purposes that I would get us out of the situation that we were in as a child. But he pulled me aside, my Uncle Dave, and he said, I expect more from you. And if you don't give me more, you can't come to this door no more. Like, I will not follow you down the route that you want to go to.
Mm.
And that was really powerful, because I would have been 12, 13, and just listening to him, and he was straight talking. He was like a fourth dan in Taekwondo. Real self-disciplined type of guy. Really nice. I wish I'd have had more role models like him when I was a kid, and I wish I'd have tapped into him maybe a little bit more. But it was easier for me to just live the alpha male youngster, if you like, so I would control what I was doing a lot of the time. Mm. Which was
he the right, like, in hindsight, was he the right person at the right time? Did you need him?
I needed them to do that. Because I loved them too, because they were angels. Like my Auntie Jane, she's passed away now, but she was like my favourite person in the whole world. And then her husband had loads of really good values, stood by them, as I say, loads of self-discipline, good job. I remember they were, I think, the first people who I knew bought their own house.
Hmm.
You know, that type of stuff. Like, it was... So for him to come hard like that, was an absolute culture shock for me, and it was the best one I've ever had. I can say that's a turning point, one of the key places in my life.
Mm. And was it then knuckled down, or was you still being a bit of a tear away from school? Like, what was the dynamic there?
So I had a bit of a reputation, I would say, not in, like, you know, crazy, but it was one that I stood by a little bit with when it comes to fighting and stuff. But I would actually go into lessons wanting to learn, and knowing that I weren't going to get into trouble. I weren't going to get chucked out of school. So I sort of... Well, there was a time when someone tried to bully me, and it sounds weird, but yeah, you sort of had to let them, because I couldn't physically do anything to them.
Mm.
And I remember it, and he gloated to me quite a few years later, which, you know, was like, yeah, you did do that. I couldn't do anything then, you know, like, to sort of look, but yeah. So the final 3 years I did, I knuckled down. I was boxing a lot, which got me fitter. The fitter I've always been, the more focused I am on life. You know, it does give me that, it releases all the right endorphins to keep me self-disciplined and on the right way.
Why did you join up?
So I was 16. It was an escape. It was an escape route. As I say, the lack of role models, I knew it would give me a whole different life and a different perspective on life. I went down, actually, with one of a friend. He was joining up. The guys in the careers office said, why don't you just take the barb test while you're here? So I ended up taking it. I'm doing quite well. And he goes, well, listen, you can do anything as a soldier. I chose, because the docs went by, I was like, oh, I'll be a welder, I'll be an engineer. And then I was with a view to being a paratrooper in the engineers, yeah. So that was the thing that hooked
me. By accident?
Then. So it was completely by accident.
Did you know anyone that was in?
No.
You know, knew nobody? No one in your family? Nothing?
My family, as I say, no one would have even dreamt of it that I know of.
Yeah. So by accident, you end up joining the Royal Engineers?
By accident, I end up in the careers office, and then when I took the test, they gave me a little bit of, yeah, okay, I can, watched a couple of videos, and then that was it. Then I had to forge my mum's signature, because I knew she'd never let me. took her back to her about just before I was going down to Lichfield to do my 2-day assessment. And I just told her where I was at. I said, like, I'm doing it now with a view to join. And this was December 99. I said, I'm going to be in quite soon. And I said, I'd love you to support me. Bear in mind, I was only 16. And it was like completely, like she had no sign of this coming off. And she was like, wow. Really shook her life, to be fair. Yeah, prominent time in her life. So I joined up. I was in, signed me up for Allegiance in December 99. And I was started training beginning of Jan.
Apprentice or adult?
No, no. When I went in, the careers office guy, he was like, in fact, it ended up being my partner now. It was her uncle. And I didn't know him, obviously, at the time. But he tapped me on the shoulder. He said, oh, you're a big lad. You can go in as an adult entry. I think there was just no apprentices coming up. So I ended up going in, and what a shock it was. I just remember turning up. I think it was Basenborn. And what a culture shock from what I was used to, a 16-year-old gobby scouse kid just getting absolutely thrashed for everything.
Yeah.
Best endeavour type.
Yeah, really. Did you improve then? Did you enjoy the structure, the discipline?
At first, it was a bit of a culture shock, but then as I grew into it really well. So by the time the end of me basic training, I can't remember much about the first 2 months, if I'm deadly honest, because I was that shocked, and it was that much being thrown at me. The last month, I remember like getting better at drill, getting better at my weapon drill, getting better on the ranges, going on the final exercises and actually thriving a little bit rather than the first couple that where I just absolutely suffered. It was just a struggle right from the way I go. And then going into like phase 2 Royal Engineer training, which was quite tough back then. Mm. You know, I've done some cheeky courses in the army and that was one of my most prominent ones. Got thrashed for 10 weeks, but I really enjoyed it. BFT time was coming down. Yeah, it was a really, really enjoyable time.
Were you proud going home?
Yeah, but again, when we look at things, my mum come to the basic training pass off. No one come to me phase 2, and it was sort of a bit of a like a feeling of when my first football match was. No one was there. When my first boxing fight was as a kid. No one was there.
Mm.
You know, these things that you sort of want people to be around with you. I'm sure a lot of other people had the families there, and when people are saying to me, you know, who are you going to give it to? There was no one who wanted to come the second time round.
Mm.
Although my mum and my uncle Dave and Jane, they come to me first time around.
So what did you do? So basic training, phase 2 combat engineer stuff, then went to trade training. Did you become a welder?
Yeah, so I went and become a welder. It was like a 9-month course down in Chatham. Pretty pointless, if I'm honest, because I've never done it ever again after it. But obviously, you know, it was a skill to learn and something that I hadn't done before. I enjoyed it. We you know,
much where I met you.
Yeah,
in a nightclub toilet. That's for another story. But a chilled out course compared to what you, so you just done like nearly a year's worth of training, then this the 9-month course at Chatham, that's chilled out.
Yeah, it was nice. It was exactly what it says. It was an apprentice type welding course, but with a little bit more structure to it and discipline with regards to PT on a couple of days a week. You had the Wednesday afternoons where you could go out and do, we played rugby, but you could do it most sports that were there, motorsports and everything. Really chilled out. I was training for P Company at the time, so I was doing loads of extra phys as well, which it gives you time, because after 5 o'clock, that was you done.
Mm. And it's not the most academic of courses, the old fabricator welders course.
No, it's not, certainly not. To be fair, I was drunk for most of it. I used to put our visors up and like rest it onto the extractor fan and then have a chipping hammer in one and a welding rod in the other and then just sleep.
Yeah.
And then as soon as like put something metal behind you, so as soon as you opened your curtain, that fell, and then all of a sudden you'd pretend to start welding.
Yeah, there were some life lessons there, mate. I did the same course, obviously, and I 9 months. I spent 3 months away playing rugby league, family final, and then had to retake my final one. I didn't know how to use some of the equipment, but it was a good time. You know, it was a good time, and lots of friendships were formed then, and they still exist today. Where'd you go after?
So as I say, I went down to Nine Squadron at the time. It was done it like a vile beat up of about 6 weeks beforehand, and then went down to P Company. While I was on P Company, I broke my leg, so got back because there was no places for in rehab for a welder. If I'd been a driver or something like that, I'd have been able to be stay there, but he posted me out then to Germany and Barker Barracks over in Paderborn, where I spent about 5 years, which was really, really good.
That's where we obviously then become mates there.
Yeah.
Optelic came, so end of 2002, we got called to Optelic to go out to Kuwait. Telic happened, we did what we did, but then Telic 3, so we came back and then went straight back out to Telic 3. What was the, did you want to go back? Because we're going to brush over Telic.
Yeah, yeah. So we done the crossing the border type. Not much action really or anything really to report home from. Then we come back, done Batters. I went out to Canada for 4 weeks. That was really good. And then I went on an NCO car there with yourself. And then went on to Telic 4. So it went out three. There, 3, sorry. It was, what was it, October?
Yeah.
October time in 2003.
Did you want to go back out?
Yeah. Yeah, I did, yeah. Because I'd volunteered for the first tour. I went with a different regiment to get out on Optelic. And then it was our regiment that was going out. As I say, you and I had been moved over to Recce Troop. And it was a tour I definitely wanted to do, yeah.
Mm. It was pretty active, there was stuff going on, and we were flying around Basra a lot, and in and out of the desert and everything else. It's a bit like the Wild West. But our staffy at the time brought you some, the first time he brought you some bad news.
Yeah, yeah, so it was a real rough period at the time, if I'm honest. So what had happened? You just left Telic. It was on the 9th of December, January. Sorry, Pete Dunn come over. So it was like, "There's, can I have a word with you?" I was like, "Oh yeah, certainly." Went into the room with the troop staffy as you do, and he's like, "Your mate at home, Chris Murphy, he's died." I was like, "Oh no!" Like me and Emma been little soulmates right the way through childhood. Really, really close, and it was heart wrenching. He had cystic fibrosis, and he'd gone into a coma just after, I think it was New Year's Eve, and then died on the 9th. Heartbreaking. I'd said, like, you know, will I be able to go back home for the funeral and stuff? And not a chance. You've got to take on the chin. You're in a theatre. You know, logistics of that was quite tough. So about three days later. Goes on an OP. It was one of the worst OPs I've ever had, really, for weather and stuff like that. It was quite shocking, really demoralising.
Where was that?
It was in Unkazar, just on the Chattalada River.
All right.
We're watching people stealing oil and ready for the bigger picture. So it was just an OP for about, would have been for about 9 days, 8 days. Remember driving back on my 21st birthday. Which is an absolute shocker. Coming through, like Alamara, you'd always get pop shot at that. And Alamara, it was just like a not very nice place to come through. Certainly at that time, like things were just getting, you know, hotter and hotter when it comes to the revolution type. So, comes back, spends about 3 or 4 days in camp, maybe a little bit longer. And then Pete said to me, "Des, can I have a word?" So I was like, "Oh yeah, certainly." Goes back in, and one of my best mates, who was out in Iraq at the time with us, had been buried to death, just literally 100 metres away from our accommodation on Basra Palace, Rab Thompson. Absolute gleaming bloke.
Yeah, shocking fucking incident.
Yeah,
shocking.
Yeah. He was, like, just one of the nicest lads you'll have ever met, like 21 years, no, he would have been 22, Rab, 23. Full of life, full of energy, goes into a hole that had been riveted, and there's talk of the digger driver may have knocked the side, or the side's just collapsed on him.
Mm.
and just, yeah, bury them alive, crush them. What a horrific way to go.
They dug a trench, hadn't they? They dug a trench, and it was very saturated, wasn't it, by the river. He'd gone in to take a soil sample. Was he a geo, wasn't he?
No, but he was doing a job for the geos, yeah.
So he was taking a soil sample, and as he was getting out, the side collapsed.
Collapsed, yeah.
Because a lot of that, my troop, they were all jumping in trying to get him out. It was fucking horrific.
Well, it was our ex-troops, because me and you had been moved to Recce Troop. They were all working together on these projects, whereas me and you were on the ground, like, doing recces constantly, like 16-hour days. Yeah.
So he told you about that then?
So he told me about that, which is, you know, again, you're in a situation, you've had two of your mates now die within the space of a couple of weeks. It's upsetting. It was, you know, you felt horrific. When I said to him, can I go back and, you know, carry the coffin and bury him, I'll come back straight back out, it's just not an option. So it was quite tough because, as I say, I'd moved squadrons to get into recce troop, and it was a hard one to swallow. And then, literally 3 days later, he said to me, "Des, can I have a word?" I was like, "Pete," I said, like, this is jokingly, by the way. I was like, "Every time you ask me," I said, "someone dies." He goes, "No, I really need to speak to you." I was like, "Oh, who the fuck can this be now?" You know.
Mm.
Goes in and he's like, "Your sister's killed herself."
Mm.
I was like, just I remember being in complete and utter shock, just thinking, like, how can this have happened? Like, what's going on? Because you don't know any of the background. All you do is get the message from someone that she's died and it's been suicide. So there's no answer. Like, you've got loads of questions, no answers. It was horrific, absolutely horrific. But within 24 hours, I was being processed then to get back and get to the funeral.
Mm.
It was a top cover, so I was still doing the job, going across over to Basra Palace, dropped up the weapons, ammunition, body armour, all that type of stuff, but I was still in desert kit and just had me bergen, so I had no civvies whatsoever, really, besides a pair of shorts and stuff that I'd just knock around the tent with. I'm going back to winter in the UK, although it was raining in Iraq. It was still quite mild at times. I remember getting off at Briars Norton, and because I was only 21, I couldn't get a hire car to drive back with. So they gave me a travel warrant so I could get the train. And regardless to what the atmospherics of the tour was, being top cover and being recce troop where you're out all the time, you were hyper-vigilant. You were scanning everything. And then to be in that zone one day, and then over in the UK, going on the underground in London, getting to Liverpool, still dressed in full desert kit with a bergen on your back, getting back to Liverpool and, like, getting home to your family and just thinking, you're in complete and utter shock. You're not in control of any sort of thought process whatsoever. I managed to get back and bury Rab, which was a bonus. I managed to get to a funeral, carried the coffin for my sister and stuff. But yeah, so Optelec 3 was pretty horrific for.
What was the atmosphere like when you got back home? Was it expected? Was there not expected? Sorry, mate. Was it shock? Was there any signs of that she was going to do this?
Well, not really a signs, but I'll tell, like, so when I was four, my dad had committed suicide, so that was the reason for his death.
Did you know that then?
No, we found out when I was about 18. Beverly would have been about 20. Bear in mind, she killed herself when she was 21, 22. No, she would have been 22, 23, sorry. So it might have been a bit later, maybe 19. And my dad's old friend had let it slip to her.
Really? You didn't know growing up?
Didn't know, mate. No, my mum and Beverly's mum both agreed to keep a bit of a pact, saying that my dad had died of a brain hemorrhage, because obviously the impact of rejection and everything else that would have had on us as children would have been epic. So we found that out by accident, really, because, as I say, someone had slipped up to Beverly, and my mum was in New York at the time, and I remember just needing answers, because Beverly just spouted it off to me. We went out for something to eat, and she's like, oh, by the way, our dad killed himself. It absolutely shook me world, but I was in the army, so I could... The busyness of being in the army was sort of a filter for the thought process. But I remember being like it was just like someone had just died again. And I don't think she ever recovered from it. I had the security, a blanket of the army, so I knew that I was going to get 3 meals a day. I knew I had discipline, I had guidance, I had, you know, a place to live. I had loads of structure in my life at the time. And, you know, I'll always look back and thank the army for giving me that, because I think it could have been me what happened with Beverly. She then searched for a love that was never out there, because obviously the rejection of a father and daughter have a really close bond, and she would have been older when my dad died as well. So she knew him a hell of a lot better than me. Yeah, so I think that was where she led to, because me and her were quite close, and she sort of always looked at me to be like the I don't know whether it was be a father figure, but certainly like an influential support. Male support. Yeah, and I went there. I was on tour. So she just when she committed suicide, she done it the same way as me dad did it, which obviously does sort of look like she's followed in his footsteps, and he's opened up the idea of a route out.
Did you resent her?
Oh, massively. Massively. I think it's because having both of them done it, do it to you feel the rejection twice. So you feel like you're sort of to blame at times. But as I say, I looked at Rab, like a real energetic, amazing lad, just been buried to death like 3 days before. And then I looked at her and I was like, that's a bit selfish. He's the same age as you. You've now taken your life. Like you had an option. He's dead. He's got no option whatsoever. That was for me a real anger point. So I would resent her, and I would sort of hold that against her for quite a while.
I mean, I will ask about opinion, but let me just move you on. Because I know, you know, we got back, you went into the boxing team, trained really hard, fought, won. After that, stuff started getting violent.
Yeah. So, yeah, as I say, had a successful boxing competition. I was really, really fit, and I'd just come off a 6 month tour month tour where I was training every single day, pretty much lifting weights. So I was a big lad, I was fit, I was aggressive, and now I was starting to become intolerant. So it reminded me of being young again, if you like. So people would do things, and I just, my tolerance levels would be quite severe. So I wouldn't give anyone an inch. But I would sort of blame the situation on them starting it rather than the way I react.
I've just realised something, you know, just speaking now. You used to keep your room so immaculate, and you used to get frustrated when people used to mess it up.
Yeah, it drive me crazy. I hated sharing rooms with people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And especially after that, that point, you couldn't abide people being...
No, and it's only just sunk into me right now of the similarities of being a youngster to that moment of time again. So I don't know whether the deaths, the hypervigilance and all the rest of it had triggered something maybe from the childhood. But then I had to admit, because I remember borrowing hoovers and stuff that to make sure that everything was spotlessly clean. So yeah, but as I say, I had about 10 fights in 2 months where some of them I was arrested for. And then I'd end up getting myself into a little bit of football violence. So I went to Armenia Bielefeld, and like was the only like real English people speaking person there. But I'd end up scrapping for them and stuff. It was as if I had a magnet to be hurt, and I was sort of like chasing this way of releasing aggression.
Did the army deal with you well?
Not really. I'm by no means a victim to the way the army processes were, because I thanked them for a hell of a lot. But I'd been arrested one night. In the daytime, there's a guy who was bullying one of the young lads in my troop. So, and he was a big lad. I think he was on steroids at the time, the lad. And so I went over and was like, that doesn't happen in my troop. And he's like, what are you going to do about it? So me and him had this big fight. It lasted for about 30 minutes. Was it? Yeah. He had broken ribs. My face was a bit mangled. So then I'd gone to sleep. I'd had a few drinks as well. And then I had another lad from the rugby team knock on my door. You wouldn't do that to me, he said. And I was like, just, fuck off, basically. Get out of my face. And then he carried on, saying, get out of here and stuff. I hit him with a punch. And it split his face, right across his cheek to his absolute lip. And then he fell unconscious on top of himself. And then I was still naked at the door. I went back in and got back in bed and was lying there asleep. And then the corporal, Abby, who lived just opposite to me, he comes screaming in, you've killed him, you've killed him. And apparently they got this lad down to the med center and he couldn't wake up for a little while. Then the RMPs come, put me in the guard room with some crazy Fijian who tried to rob a tank. And he was off, I don't know where he'd been on, but he was chucking beds at the doors and everything. It was crazy. But I was just lying there, just dead calm. And I remember speaking to the RCMO and the Padre come, and they were like, "What? How are you feeling?" And I was quite numb, and nothing had shocked me. And they're like, "What we're going to do is we're going to send you on leave, give you a little bit of time out. We were seeing things that we're quite concerned about." So I said, that would be awesome. I went away, spent a month on leave. It was around the time of summer leave anyway, so it was coming up, but I just went a bit early. Come back, and they got me to see a psychiatric nurse in Allenbrook Barracks. I'd done a couple of sessions, and basically, I remember asking me a question. I always had aspirations to join the SAS. I wanted to go Special Forces. An old RSM who planted the seed, and I thought that would be my next release, something really tough that I could really focus and set a purpose on. And we were going through the council, and she was like, are you sure you want this on your record? And I was like, no. And it was like, well, basically we can't carry on to see you if that's the case. So I went back. The RCMO had got me 6 months leave to go and I'm basically R&R, I think it was, just or just
off you go,
get me out of the regiment type thing, I think, because as I say, it was
because you were you're well liked and very good.
Yeah,
just there was some stuff that
you don't know at the time, and you start feeling like you're a bit of an alien, and you're thinking you don't know yourself. I don't know what it was like for me and you when we went out, whether there's any problems, but I know in myself, I was always nervous about a reaction and what was going to come next. But by sending me home for 6 months, sent me to an environment that I'd grew up in, that I'd escaped from, and was absolutely tailor-made for someone with loads of aggression to go back into that. So when I say, I thanked the army. That was what I would say was a catalogue of errors that really didn't help me at all, put me into that environment, which then led to me then signing off. And I was out within probably 6 months after the leave.
You got out end of 2007, beginning of 2008. A few odd jobs here and there, but then you ended up doing close protection, first in the UK, and then you went to places like Afghan and Yemen. But the one thing that I think you saw something in yourself that you wasn't too happy with, and that's when you went and joined 2-3 SAS Reserves, nearby to you. And what was What did that impact have on you?
So I think going into CP was probably the best thing I ever done. And I remember trying to save, because I was on real crap wages. It was 2008 when the crash was, and I was doing building work. You know what I mean? It was never going to be a success. I remember 80 quid a day, I think I was on. I was just saving up every penny I could, and I managed to get like £1,200. And then someone told me about the Poppy Appeal, is it?
The British Legion.
British Legion Poppy Appeal, and basically they would help me. Now, I said to them, I've got 1,200 quid to go on this course. The course was £3,500. And they were like, well, it seems you've got that amount. We'll fund the rest. So I'd done the CP course. It was really good. It was a shock. It was like getting back into the military again, where you had to be on the ball.
Mm.
And I hadn't had that sort of pressure on me for a long time, which I thrived on. I really enjoyed it. It was like a mini Carder, if you like an NCO Carder. You were doing recce's, you were doing phys, you were doing essays. You were up like 17-hour days sometimes, very little sleep. It was really good, high intensity, and it was 21 days straight, no weekends off or nothing like that. So it was, I loved it. From that, I got a job doing security for the Olympics, or the build-up to the Olympics. And then there was a job come up with Armour Group out in Afghan. I'd done a little bit there, not like literally weeks, and then I was back. Because the pay was that poor, and then I ended up getting back onto this Olympic job, which was really good. Done sharing like the arena with like loads of ex-SF blokes, so a lot of people from 2-2, 2-1 and 2-3 on this job that I was on, and they were like, just go and do it, go and do it. And I was like, okay, put my name down for it, signed for it. I was 17 and a half stone at the time, couldn't run 4 miles. And then within, I would say, five or six months, I was on selection course, yeah. Mm. Which is like a 12-month period of time for the reserves. 10 weekends, a two-week camp just before you go on and do the final 2 weeks of the four for the hills.
Mm.
It was really good, but I think having that extra weight really helped me. Although, like, speaking to the instructors afterwards, they said, I had no chance. They said, well, fatty won't fatty. Yeah.
I remember, you know, you taking it through, and I remember I was like cleaning a fire appliance or something like that when you rang me and said, I've passed.
Yeah.
I remember you rang me and said that. Did it give you that structure? Did it give you that kind of safety blanket? Is that what you was looking for?
Yeah, joining the army at 16, done 8 years, I was secure for seven of them. It was only that last year where I lost a little bit, and then coming out I must have been about 16 to 18 months, I'd lost all structure, and I felt like not a part of anything. I'd lost all my purpose. As I say, it was only by back being around like squaddy lads on the CP course. And then in the CP arena, which then was like, it gave me the little bit of taste that I needed then to go and seek to join back up the army. It wouldn't have been worth me joining an engineer reserve unit at the time. So, you know, 2-3 was the definite location for me. And there was no way I was not going to get through it.
Yeah.
And it was, they give me everything and more than what I was looking for.
Yeah.
The safety blankets. The camaraderie, the skill set, you know, you were constantly learning and improving all the time.
You took that skill set as well. We'll come away from 2-3, but you took that skill set. Did a lot of work then in places like, you know, we said like Yemen and Djibouti, Sudan and Nigeria. And I always got the feeling that you just become like desensitized to a lot of stuff, because we were seeing each other and speaking to each other kind of sporadically amongst all this time. But at this point in your life, I always felt like that was the moment where that, like, you didn't, because I was totally grounded in the fire service. Like, yeah. I was with that group of people, you know, the house down the road, you know, playing rugby with my mates on the weekend. And you just felt like it was this one extreme, you know, doing 2-3, then another extreme, you're in Nigeria doing some stupid stuff that we're not going to go into today, but like just being quite reckless, I feel.
Yeah, yeah. So,
and then back, you know, going partying for a week in Ibiza or whatever it was, you know.
Yeah. I mean, life was really intense. What I'd done is I think it was a bit of suffering, but I kept everything at the highest level. So everything was intense. So whether it would be a relationship, I'd be like, it would be really intense, or whether I'm out in like a dangerous area. Like in our villa, they used to lock three doors and then say, you know, don't go out and we'll come and get you in a day or two, whenever you were due to go and do a job or do anything. And I'd just get out and put a knife in a bag and then go and have a few pints. And like pay one of the locals to take me around on the back of a bike, which the thought process, you were prime target to being taken. Certainly in Nigeria and in West Africa, it was pretty hideous. So that you know, when you look back now, you say massively desensitized. You had no value for your life. You couldn't really settle in any sort of like love relationship with it. Just wouldn't have happened. Your tempo was too fast. Come away, I'd spent like 3 months away. Come via Heathrow just to see you. To be fair, that's where I used to go. Come through there and then fly out to Ibiza, where then I'd be partying and having like the best times. My adventure then would be going skydiving. Everything had to be like at a really high level of intensity. I think there was a bit of fear of just dropping down into normality.
I hope not too much. I mean, I remember you used to come to ours, and you still do now. You'll be here tonight. You're there tonight, but you used to come to ours, and it felt like, oh, like it's a little bit more. I can relax now for a little bit before I go off.
Yeah, your house has always had this. That it's like a real comfort and safe zone for me. And now even more so, because back then I didn't see obviously the kids growing up and that, but you and Alain had it where we were, you know, it was, I just really enjoyed coming and staying. It was something I always aspired to have myself. So the first time I tried hummus, for instance, was in your house.
Hey, I've got street cred here.
Olives, all these things were the first time. Like I tried new foods, and it was just, you had a really warm, welcoming place. But then obviously, I would be coming through yours to go to the next adventure, and that's where the sharp realities were. I'd had, having a nice time with you, and then back into the.
I remember a phone call after you'd come back from Nigeria. It was a big deal, and you'd been arrested, and you got into trouble, you know, with the law, and that lasted for a period of time. And again, you were at our house quite a lot. We were backwards and forwards to court. After that, I think it must have been about a 2-year period, you walked out of the court. Your daughter was then born, and then me and you sat down and we said, like, what do we want? We wanted to get you out of, or get you back home and that stability. Again, you'd been totally desensitized in West Africa and to corruption and to violence and to just like the poverty of the kid with the kids that we're living in. And we sat down. And this is where I think the growth kind of mentality comes in. This is where, for me, looking at you, this is where you're coming into your own now. Like, we sit here and you've educated nearly 3,500, or provided 3,500 days of education, 50,000 days of clean drinking water, amongst a host of other things. And we sat down and what happened?
Yeah, so going back, desensitization, there's a lot of people out on the circuit who do this. They go away and basically that's your life. You're just wishing it away. I needed some sort of purpose. As I say, my little girl was being born in the June, and when I remember doing a security job down south, and you'd said to me, "Do you want to come and do a bit of work for me?" And you were doing pest control on your 4 off from the fire brigade, and then I earned more money then doing that, and I was like, you said, "Come back, stop chasing, you know, the cash out abroad, and let's make something meaningful." After going to all these different countries, Sudan, Yemen, as I say, all West Africa, you notice the poverty hits the children. They've still got the smiles on their face. I remember like going to church one day, and I'm not religious in any way, but just watching people who haven't got anything really took me back to me as a kid. and how happy they are with very little. And I think that was one of the reasons why now we assist children in those conflict areas. Mm. So when setting the company up, we needed to have a clear vision, didn't we? And it was to create amazing global impacts. Number one, was to employ our military veterans. Number two, to assist children in conflict areas. That's where the 3,500 days of education have come from. I think 45,000 people clean drinking water. Number three, it was obviously to protect our customer. And number four, to support our injured service personnel. Hence, the foundation of this podcast itself.
Well, I think I always think we got it slightly wrong then. Looking at hindsight, you know, we said we wanted to support our injured service personnel, which, you know, we've done, you know, or we're doing, you know, whether that's raising funds or employment or advocating employment. But it was the kind of concept of this podcast where we could do it at scale. We didn't know where it was going to take us, but...
Yeah, well, I think between us, we've raised over like £5,000 worth of for mental health charities, the combat stress, the poppy practice, and that is great, and we'll continue to do that. But as you said, to hit a wider audience and to give them value, the podcast was a great idea and a great foundation. And it's now, when I look back, it's probably the thing I'm most proud of, what we've achieved. I don't know about yourself, but. We set it up to help people suffering from PTSD and combat stress. It ended up that it's you know, listening to Walter Busuttil, number four, and then sitting in on the first one with David Wiseman, number 12. They changed my life. When Walter was talking about the effects of PTSD, I like little light bulbs were coming on in my brain, thinking, I wonder if I've suffered from this. Because if that sounds like, similar things that have happened to me, certainly with nightmares, with conversations. So I could be having a conversation with people, and then I'd start talking about my aunt slicing her wrist in front of us, for instance. And then David Wiseman's, he then, listening to his, just was the light bulb. Yeah, you've got, I think it was complex PTSD, they call it. And it's more from the childhood rather than from the actual military itself. But the same symptoms. So the nightmares, you know, the sleepless, there's the stress that it comes with not getting enough sleep, and the way you manage things as well needs to be taken into account. Listen to him. He really, really struggled. And it opened up my eyes.
Because, I mean, we, and just to go back, what I think we got wrong was we said... And we're going to support
those. Yeah.
And I think it's now it's full circle, and it's those that have been injured that are supporting everyone else, and it's blown up much bigger. The episode 12 we did with Wisey, we met up. It was the first time you'd gone into a studio. We'd met up. You was on the other side of the glass. Me and Wisey was in the studio. You listened afterwards. I remember this big long kind of WhatsApp came from him giving some advice.
Yeah. No, he was integral to me getting help, to be fair, because when we come out of it, I was talking to him a bit, and I was like, you know what, I think you've just like turned the light bulb on my head. And he was like, he was really, really, really supportive. He sent me a lovely message though, and it basically explained about like me pushing me towards therapy, because in my head I was thinking, I don't need therapy. I've like this. These are things that have happened. I've been out the army now for about 4 or 5 years. I've got businesses. I've got a beautiful like missus and a lovely daughter. I've got loads of support around the family. And I was thinking, I don't need therapy, but I was suffering really bad. My aunt, who said to you about slicing her wrist, she had died in October last year, and I'd carried the coffin. Bearing in mind, I really didn't want to at the time, because I still resented her from all the hate that we got from as children. I started having nightmares that I would be lying in bed. I'd have my little baby girl in my arms, and she'd be opposite, stabbing herself in like her chest and stuff. So it was really warping my memories. There was loads of other vicious nightmares of being chased, and if girls had really come and got a grip of me. And, you know, before Christmas, I found myself down the docks in Birkenhead, which was a good distance away from my house, really. And it was winter, obviously freezing cold. If they fell in or jumped in, you wouldn't get out of there. There's not a chance. Loads of people have died in the same location. And I remember phoning my partner, Nick, and I was like, if she answers, I'll be all right. If she doesn't, I'm going to go in. And that sort of, like, shock reality, bear in mind, she never answers the phone, you know yourself. She doesn't have it with her. So, like, so it, the odds of her doing it was very, very limited at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Mm.
She answered and come and pick me up straight away. Now, I was in, like, the worst place that I can ever remember. And mentally, this had just popped up on me. Like, there was no warning signs. Years ago, I used to get angry. This made me really timid. It made me go inside myself and really worry about, like, what people thought about me. I was getting anxiety was kicking in. So it was a complete spin from the old aggressive, like people can go, my mum would notice things and go, calm down.
Mm.
You're snapping a little bit. Are you all right? No one asked me, was I all right? Because I come into myself and no one could see that there was a problem. So it was a completely different symptom that I hadn't seen before. And I nearly, I was about to take my own life. And I still think now, if it weren't for the podcast, certainly number four and Wisey, I would have killed myself.
I remember you ringing me and telling me, and we have in the last 12 months, laughed and cried and for various reasons on the phone and together and done everything else in between. And I remember you telling me, and I said, look, can I ring him up and tell him what's going on here? Because he might be able to give me some support to support you. And he did. And did you then speak with...
Yeah, so we were messaging back and forth. I'd been to see Carla from the Poppy Practice.
Yeah.
And what a great organisation that is. You give her literally a message or a call. She's on Twitter, she's on Facebook, all the likes. And she will get you in front of a counsellor very, very quick. So with me, it was a week. And then I went to my first session and wow. I was completely and utterly drained. It was probably one of the hardest things I've ever done. It brought back memories that I didn't even know existed. So, like, other different abuse when I was a little bit older. I don't really want to go into it at the minute because I'm still working through and I can't get my head around it.
Mm.
But it was more probably the worst thing that's happened to me, but I completely blocked it out. And I remember saying to Dave, like, this isn't, like, it's too hard. It's like, this is, it's draining me because I had you by my side and the team, Sean, Amy, the lads on the ground. I was just taking naps in the day to try and manage this situation because I weren't sleeping overnight. So, but then the fear then of letting you guys down was quite tough. So that's why I was talking to you about it all the time. I know it was a really heavy moment, but I had to offload it. And then Wisey said to me in a message, he said, think of it like cleaning a pond. Now, this won't be the word where the eel
can say. Can I just give you some context? It's because the problem you had, because you spoke to me about it,
yeah.
And I didn't understand the dream situation. The problem you had was, why is your daughter and other family members, why are we dreaming and the people who was part of the abuse earlier on in childhood, why is it all getting kind of amalgamated? Because that's the stuff that you couldn't get your head around.
Well, what it is because you bring it all up, you can't control, you can't remember what was right memory wise like your memories are that distorted. You think sometimes you're telling, I have to ask people whether things actually happen now because I don't trust my memories. So that I'm like, as I say, I've been having therapy for a while. I pay for it now to keep me functioning, but it's really good. But at the time, it was just completely distorted. And what, as I say, what Wisey said is, picture yourself getting into a pond, a dirty lake with a filter. He said, you start cleaning this pond. What happens? All the dirt from the bottom all rises to the top and that becomes pitch black. So you can't see anything from the top downwards. But if you carry on, you get rid of it all. If you stop, sorry, he said, then it'll all just sink back down to the bottom, and it'll. But you'll never get to the root cause of the problem, and that's what I was thinking about doing, stopping at the time because it was so difficult. But he said, "What you've got to do, you've already braved it. Now you're in the dirty, wet mud. You're cold. You're freezing. Keep digging to the bottom, and as you get rid of all this dirt, it's not all going to go. So there'll still be little bits, but you'll clear the filter." And basically the dirt then will be manageable. And as I say, it'll stick with you forever. However, it's not going to clog up, if you like. Mm. And that was sort of, he said it so much better, and certainly with his posh accent. But yeah, no, and that really stuck with me. And having that support, as I say, and speaking to people and telling people if you need a nap or if I need a day off just to revolve. I said it to you, didn't I? Listen, I'm going to take off today or the rest of the day. Now, some people aren't in that position, but I think you ask your boss and tell them what you're going through, a lot of people are going to be a lot more sympathetic to support you when you're going through this.
I mean, I think the conversation is definitely changing, you know, and I think it's about being open about stuff. And it's mad to think now that we started this for others. You know, we have no self-interest in this. As in, this is not an ego trip. It's not, we're not raising our profile. This is nothing to do with anything except supporting other people. And by doing that and being so, I think, we have been genuine and we've been, focus-driven, have our vision driven.
Yeah, we stuck to it, haven't we? Yeah.
I know because we've had previous conversations that this has helped save your life.
Yeah.
And especially episode 12, you know, why has it saved your life?
There's loads of other people though, mate, who have come to me, and like one guy who works on the train, Matty, this helps other people. It's not just about our military community, even though it was aimed towards that. You've had firemen coming to you saying how much it's helped them. I've got civilian lads who absolutely love the podcast, but then are saying, listening to what these heroes are going through, and then they're talking about the post-traumatic growth, the other side of it. So for me now, I feel in the best place I've ever felt. Don't get me wrong, I still pay for additional therapy. So now, for instance, I'll have a sports myself once a week, certainly with this boxing competition coming up. But I also have a therapy session once a month. Mm. Now, I'm completely fine. I'm fine on all cylinders, but I just dump any negative thoughts. I just talk to them. I've got a really good counsellor as well. You know, he just listens to me. I vent out for an hour, but I'm not passing it on to anyone else. I'm not, you know, I can be completely
open. You're keeping that filter going. And,
yeah.
And like you said, we go for physiotherapy. This is almost mental physiotherapy, and you're just keeping on top of things, and you know how to do that. Des, mate, it's been an absolute pleasure. You are a role model to me, an inspiration, a great mate. We will leave it there.